Lily on 14 August 79. So we were talking about H1 absorption. You say they had discovered this phenomenon.
When I arrived at NRL, the phenomenon had been discovered, and as I found out later in my notebook that I kept at the time of my thesis, Fred Whipple had suggested to me that it might be interesting to look in the direction of discrete sources and observe the spectrum of hydrogen in those directions. And pretty clearly what Fred had in mind was the analogy between that configuration and interstellar absorption lines in the spectra of stars.
Right.
Now, in the case of hydrogen, I believe the technique that Hagen and MacLean had used was to tune to a particular frequency with these single-channel systems we were discussing earlier, tune to the peak of the hydrogen line, I point the antenna adjacent to the discrete source, which, as I recall, was Taurus A. Then, while tracking the peak of the hydrogen line, swing the antenna beam through the discrete source, and when they did this, they found that the peak intensity of the hydrogen line went through a null coincident with the position of the discrete source. Apparently, they had not considered or had not yet obtained the spectrum in the direction of the source. One evening that I vividly recall, MacLean and I had an opportunity to do this. We set up the 50-foot antenna pointed toward the discrete source Cassiopeia A and started scanning in frequency, and I vividly recall MacLean kicking the radiometer that Ewan had sold to the Naval Research Laboratory because the old chart recorder was quite literally banging from one limit of the scale to the other, and we had to reduce the gain on the recorder to get the spectrum on scale. And for hours that evening, we scanned back and forth through the spectrum of Cass A, watching these three huge absorption lines come and go repeatedly. It became clear that evening that Cass A was beyond the second spiral arm, and we knew that the Bode-Mankowski result of 500 parsecs was off at least by a factor of six and possibly more.
Now, are you saying that right from the first time you observed it, you already had in your mind this interpretation of distances and so
on? Well, we knew that if the absorption occurred in by the time MacLean and I were observing that weekend, I believe we had sufficient discussions to be at ease with the idea that absorption of the continuum from the discrete source was probably the responsible agent.
And you had thought about the idea of using it as a distance indicator also?
Oh, sure. But this, whatever tentative thoughts we may have had, were certainly galvanized that evening because it was clear that there was a lot of gas between us and Cass A.
Were you influenced at all by the Davies and Williams paper about the same time suggesting this as a distance method? Do you remember the Nature short paper?
I remember the paper. The timing, I don't recall.
54 is the date of that.
Yeah. So no, I don't recall.
Okay.
The problem became how to write it down. How to write down what was going on. That possessed me for a while. I couldn't get that out of my mind, and knew that while getting the distance was interesting, and the impact on the distance to Cass A in particular was considerable interest in the astronomical community, the lingering problem was to attempt to write down the radiative transfer considerations. And I first tried that using a cloud model, and it went into an NRL report. A copy of that report went to Ed Purcell, who was traveling frequently to Washington and came by to see me at NRL.
Mm-hmm.
And he explained to me that all of the omegas that we were using to write it down, the omega I's and the omega J's, had kept him up one full evening. And he drew a three-dimensional diagram on the blackboard. He said he thought that if he understood all of the omegas, he could probably draw it. You know how Ed is, and reducing everything to startling simplicity.
Okay, these were beam solid angles and cloud solid angles
and solid angles for the absorbing clouds, and of course you had commingled with this the opacity of the cloud, the angular size of the discrete source, the beam, and well, on and on.
Right.
So he reduced space to an angular one dimension amplitude for another coordinate of both the to represent both the continuum and the emission of the cloud, and frequency in another axis. So on this configuration, the discrete source looked like a wall, continuous in frequency, rising in intensity to a peak, and then disappearing in angle.
Right.
So it was really a wall, and hydrogen clouds, being monochromatic, occupied only a finite width on the frequency scale.
Right.
Were much weaker than the in intensity than the discrete source in terms of brightness temperature, and if they happened to lie in front of the discrete source and were opaque, they would cut a notch in the wall.
It was just the difference between the two temperatures,
right? And so we liked that diagram very much and had it drawn up at the NRL art department that made up that sort of thing. And it got passed around quite a bit. We mailed it back to Bach here at Harvard, who rolled it out on the floor one evening at Agassiz Station and asked all of the students, he told me, to explain it. So
So in the
early days.
Hagen, Lilly, and McLean 55 APJ paper that went through all this theory, that was primarily your contribution, was the theoretical interpretation of the and all this equation of transfer and so forth.
Well, yeah, I spent a lot of time on that and tried it out on everyone I could find at NRL, Haddock, Mayer, physicist named Ament, who may or may not still be there.
You haven't explicitly mentioned the business about, in the first paper by Hagen and McLean themselves, that it appears that what they're saying is they thought that the continuum source is actually blocking the hydrogen. Is this a fair statement?
That seemed to be the impression when I arrived, and I think that's the impression you get from the first brief paper. But those were lively days, and the transition from that concept over to the one that we finally published occupied a lot of hours of discussion and trial and error at NRL.
Sure. Well, it's easy to look back now and say, well, how could they have thought that? But
I do remember Purcell's gentle comment about the complications of the cloud model, putting everything in terms of small solid angles and attempting in a way to use a summation procedure to write down the equation of transfer. And in those days we were traveling a bit for the Navy, and McLean and I went on a trip to West Virginia to look at a site which I believe was
Sugar Grove.
Considered for Sugar Grove.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere in my file is the stationery from some motel where McLean and I stayed, and being unable to sleep one night, I got up early the next morning, 4 or 5 a.m., and started an attempt to write down the transfer consideration the way it should have been written down in the first place, and I finally got that right, which is in the tail end of the article.
I see. I can add it on.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Continuing NRL. You had another paper in APJ in which you talked about the idea of using a big dish in the looking for absorption was a more sensitive method of detecting lines, and so you obviously were thinking about other line possibilities. Can you tell me how that
went? Well, of course, we all discussed after hydrogen what's next, and we all were considering various ways to increase the sensitivity of the system. Now, it turns out that particular suggestion of looking at absorption against discrete sources is that does not account for the increase in the
system
noise.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, that's always been and we knew that. And there had always been some debate about, isn't it easier to look for a big signal than a weak signal? Both of them in the presence of comparable noise. And you have to decide for yourself on that one.
Right. What lines were you thinking about at that time? And then I know that you actually did do a search for OH with Al Barrett.
Well, I'd have to go back and look at the paper. I suspect if we that we were aware at least of the OH lines. The papers by Towns and Schlafsky.
They had mentioned CH.
Wasn't OH?
Well, OH was the main thing, but
yeah.
Also CH was mentioned,
yeah.
And even the water vapor line was mentioned by Towns.
Yeah. And most of us in those days were in close touch with Towns. In fact, I made a number of trips to Columbia. Gave some early colloquia there. Those lines undoubtedly must have been, you know, in mind. And in those days, I don't recall the timing exactly, but Al Barrett did show us. There's a new employee, I'm not sure whether for 1 year or longer.
Yeah, I think he had an appointment, fellowship or something for a year or something.
And I do recall that we worked out the OH problem on the blackboard. The reason I recall it so vividly is that he taught me about the physics of OH, and I taught him about the observational situation between here and Cass A.
Mm-hmm.
We combined those things, and on the blackboard, because the photograph was happened to be taken at the time, is a prediction of the opacity in the direction of Cass A.
That's
the strongest component. And on the photograph, it says 0.16. And in the paper that Barrett participated in some years later, the published opacity is 0.16.
This is about 10 years later, actually.
Well, yeah, sometime
almost,
later.
Yeah. Was this official NRL photograph that was taken?
Oh, it's around in the files here somewhere. I suppose it was, yeah. I'm sure there weren't any cameras around in the...
NRL. Oh, that's right. They have to be official, right?
They would have to be. Oh, hold on a second. I'll see if I can.
So, you then apparently said, well, let's go out and try to find this OH line.
Yeah, Al and I looked for OH. I suppose this was in 56.
Yeah.
I suppose we looked at we didn't know the frequency precisely then, so it was a bit of a chore. I'm reasonably certain we looked at Cass A. I think a comet came through at about the same time, and we took a quick look at the comet.
For the OH line?
The OH line. I suppose, in retrospect, if we had looked at the galactic center, we would have found it, from what we now know about the size of the line.
Yeah, I've looked at that report, and I think the frequency was off.
Right.
And I can't remember now if it crossed at some point or whether it was just the center of your search was way off. I can't remember, but that certainly was the first search for OH that I know about anyway. It went into an NRL report. I was just wondering why you didn't publish it in the standard astronomical literature.
I would have thought we did as an abstract anyway.
Well, it was an abstract, an AJ meeting, a AAS meeting.
I probably didn't think it
that
was
more efficient.
Than that. It
was were there any other searches that were done for other lines at that time?
I don't recall. I had had an interest all along in lines. I gave a colloquium here on other lines when I was a student and had a chapter in my thesis on other lines, including carbon monoxide, which Bart convinced me it would be prudent to remove that chapter.
Oh, well, this is in your draft you had.
I'm sorry, yes, in the draft. Be prudent to remove that because of its speculative qualities.
I see. Okay, now, also while at NRL, you and Ed McLean apparently decided to try to look for hydrogen in Cygnus A. Now, was your idea just to look for absorption like you had done in Cass and Taurus, or were you thinking about looking for emission?
Well, I think we must have been influenced by the absorption history and undoubtedly expected to see absorption. We looked, and we looked over fairly substantial frequency range, looking, I suppose, for narrow features, again being right. influenced by Cassie and Sonon.
But were you looking at 0 kilometers a second range, I mean galactic range, for these absorption features, or were you looking?
Well, in the beginning we looked at, we of course included Cassie in the local survey, Cygnus A in the local survey.
Oh, okay.
And we looked for that. And then I believe Bada and Minkowski, I believe those were the people who
right.
worked on the,
they measured
on
the redshift.
They measured the redshift. We used the redshift and then thought there might be hydrogen in the vicinity of the source and looked for that.
Okay.
We thought, I suppose, we were going to find narrow lines. Never did. Then saw what looked to be like a gentle and broad absorption line at about the right frequency. Possibility of baseline effects was very much on our mind, and we used another discrete source, I'm not sure which one, and took the ratio of Cygnus A to that other discrete source. And even that ratio showed a gentle absorption line of considerable breadth. And we presumed that was the absorption at the source, and published it. It turned out later when we, I think it was Davies, tried it at Jago Bank,
right.
And we again tried it at Maryland Point with the 84 foot,
yeah.
And couldn't. No one was able to reproduce that. And to this day, I don't know what in the ratio of the two antenna temperatures could have caused that problem. But we gave the data to a number of other people at NRL blindly and asked them to reduce the spectrum.
As you know, these things still happen today. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I suppose if we had to do it all over again, we'd do it exactly the way we did it.
Was there any trouble in operating so far away from the 1420 line? Interference or in tuning the receiver? Any
no interference that I recall, and the system locked all right. Noise figure measured out to be essentially the same.
Were you still tuning a single channel?
Well, we were using the broad channel. We weren't tuning at all. We were actually measuring the antenna temperature at a specific frequency for two sources and taking the ratio as a measure, the ratio of the two antenna temperatures as a measure of the ratio of the flux for the two objects, which should be invariant across the spectrum over a small
range. Right.
And that resulting plot could be interpreted as a reduction in the flux coming from Cygnus A at the right frequency.
Okay, were there any other projects you worked on at NRL?
There were. In those days, you spent some fraction of your time on NRL objectives and the remainder on pure research. And what we've been talking about was the pure research side. I did work on some other programs which occupied an awful lot of our time. One was radar returns from sea state conditions. These were experiments carried out from the bridge over the river down on, what is it, 301, that's south of
the
city. There's a huge bridge down there, the name of which now escapes me.
You mean the one that's a mile south of NRL or the one that's way down south?
No, way down.
Yeah.
Way down.
I know the one you mean. I can't remember the name either.
And we used to have a system set up hanging over that and measuring. There was a good fetch across that water, and you can get a variety of sea states right there. Then another program we worked on was Doppler radar as an airspeed indicator for devices to give the landing signal officer on aircraft carriers the landing speed of planes coming in to land. As I recall, this was the early days of jets attempting to land on carriers, and mm-hmm. had some trouble judging the critical speed. And I suppose it was research at that time, both at NRL and elsewhere, that led to the day-to-day radar speed traps that we enjoy now.
Sure. And you also mentioned that you looked for a site for what became Sugar Grove.
The Sugar Grove program was coincident with my, or the beginnings of it were coincident with my stay at NRL. McLean and I went on a number of occasions to the hills of Virginia and West Virginia looking for suitable sites.
And was the initial purpose of Sugar Grove indeed the Big Dish, or was it?
Yes, the initial purpose was the 600-foot antenna that was ultimately terminated by the Secretary of Defense.
Right. I've talked to him and others about that. You weren't directly involved in that, except for the site survey?
No, not only in the site survey. Yeah. And toward the end, as I recall, we were directly involved when NRL, I believe, decided that after all, it might be a good idea to include the basic research justification. And I suppose this was a downhill last-ditch fight to salvage the antenna.
Right.
And we did work for long hours producing basic research justifications for the 600-foot antenna. And I presume those documents vanished.
While you were at NRL, or this is later?
No, this is why I believe this was while mm-hmm. I was at NRL. I'm sure it was.
And so you left NRL in 57, you were saying?
I think that's right.
And then
off to the immediate cause of relocation was the emergence of Project Vanguard. I was returning from a trip to Europe with John Hagen,
mm-hmm.
and it was on this trip that Hagen was named head of Project Vanguard. And there was, I believe, a considerable reorganization at NRL at that time, and Hagen was going to head up what then became Project Vanguard, and I thought that over and decided that was the time to go to Yale, and did.
And now, in the period 57 to 60, I really don't see many publications dealing with radio astronomy anyway. So was this a quiet period at Yale in terms of research? Or?
Well, it was a period when...
what was your goal at Yale,
The goal at Yale was to begin raising funds to... at that time, I think a number of us still thought that universities would be strong centers of radio astronomy. Mm-hmm. It was even later that we got to the thought of regional facilities as mm-hmm. a fallback from strong institutions. But my purpose was to go to Yale and to build up a program at Yale in radio astronomy. And these early years were very much involved in writing proposals, mm-hmm. raising money, and getting the enterprise underway. And there were no facilities at Yale at that time. I think I did at that time go back occasionally to NRL and work with McLean on some experiments. I guess that was the time when we again, with the 84-footer, tried to reproduce the results on CNSA.
Now, was Brower the head at Yale?
Brower was then the director at Yale.
So he must have wanted to get radio astronomy going.
He wanted to get radio astronomy going, but perhaps even more so, Harlan Smith wanted to get it going.
Mm-hmm.
And Harlan was instrumental in attracting me to Yale. And we worked together a bit during those years to try to get it going. Harlan being interested very much in the Jupiter situation, helped bring the equipment to Yale, and Douglas was a student in those days.
Yeah, I've talked to Harlan about that, but I didn't actually realize that you were involved directly in the Jupiter stuff, though, were you?
No. He was. He had, as I say, an independent.
What kind of program did you want to get going then?
Well, we again with the help of NRL, I arranged to have a Wurzburg 24-foot antenna moved to the Yale Observatory out in Bethany.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, I suddenly decided to come to Harvard due to a change of situations here. We had just moved to the Yale Observatory, a 24-foot Wurzburg antenna that I had talked to the management at NRL into donating, for the sake of education and research, this instrument they had to Yale. So I presume, had I stayed, and this would have been the first instrument at Yale, an equatorially mounted 24-footer Wurzburg for hydrogen. As I recall, Dirk Brau and I were interested in the solar parallax at that time.
Right.
And I'm not sure what else, but that would have been the way things might have developed at Yale.
But in any case, this instrument really never got used for anything. I've never heard of any results that came from it.
No, the antenna title had been transferred to Yale, and I had it delivered, and the mounting was delivered. Site was selected, and I believe the foundation went in. But I believe that nothing further was done with that at all after I left.
And then you came to Harvard.
Tom Gold had just left Harvard, and again, Donald Menzel, that had crossed my path years earlier as a student, was instrumental and invited me up one weekend and asked me would I consider coming. And that was a bit of a problem, because I had indeed succeeded in raising some money for Yale.
Yeah.
And the question became, could I preserve that momentum and transfer those funds from Yale to Harvard? And after a bit of enterprise, the answer was yes.
Yeah. And now, was this to be head of the radio group after Gold?
In the sense that it had a head, it was only, I think, head in the sense that one was then the principal investigator for the grant that made radio astronomy possible. Those were the days of the first masers at Harvard for hydrogen line research. I believe Eugene Epstein was one of the early students.
And Mort Roberts is also here then.
Mort Robertson came a bit later.
And the thrust, it seems, of the research shifted from galactic work to external galaxies.
With the masers, it became feasible to do the extragalactic hydrogen work, and both Epstein and Mort Roberts pursued that vigorously.
Now, it seems like from your publications up through 62, where my bibliography ends, that your own interests, however, were more in space radio astronomy and the prospects for that. Is that correct?
Well, my own personal interests certainly went in that direction, although there were a number of responsibilities still with the hydrogen program. Getting the masers to work reliably, as I recall, was we never quite trusted a single spectrum on the extragalactic nebulae in the beginning. In fact, the reliability of the hydrogen data, I think, was my major concern. It was certainly the major concern that Menzel had. It was the only point that he discussed with me with great care. It was clear that Harvard was extremely sensitive about the quality and accuracy of the data. And in those days, I spent an awful lot of time worrying about specifically that.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Never mind the interpretation that Epstein and Roberts might have placed upon the spectra later, but
were the bumps real? Yeah.
Were they real? But as you said, my own taste went into, I believe at that time, the millimeter observations from the Mariner probe to see whether Venus had limb brightening or limb darkening, as the ionospheric or the hot surface model would have predicted.
This is Mariner 2, I believe?
Yeah. Mariner 1 was destroyed by the range safety officer. Mariner 2 made it all the way.
And those really are the first microwave observations done from space, I think. Is that a fair statement?
That was the first probe to another planet, and I believe those were the first.
What was the main scientific results to come out of that?
Well, I believe it settled the question of limb brightening or limb darkening. It was clearly a case of limb darkening, and I believe eliminated the possibility that Venus could be the meteorological twin of the Earth, having a comfortable environment as a place to go in the future in the space program. It was clearly a hostile environment. Clearly, the temperature originated at the surface due to the limb darkening, and the measurement has held up. It is indeed near 700 or 800 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right. Was the point that if there was limb brightening, that it might be an ionospheric contribution?
That's right.
To the temperature.
Right. The competitive model at that time was to the hot surface model was an ionosphere with a cool surface. I mean, a surface something like yeah. the Earth, and that the spectrum of Venus at long wavelengths, which showed 600 degrees, was in fact not showing the surface, but showing an ionosphere peculiar mm-hmm. to Venus. And that model predicted limb brightening, whereas the observation showed it to be a limb darkening case.
Let me just go back to the reliability of the H1 measurements. During the period about precisely when you were gone, namely 55 to 60, there were some overinterpretations of bumps and so forth, which I've talked to various people about. Is this what you were reacting against, essentially, that a reputation developed for overinterpretation, shall we say?
Well, I think it wasn't as much overinterpretation as it was the reality or the accuracy of the spectra produced here in those days. My impression is that sort of after the very early days, Ewan and Purcell, and then the 24-foot very first year or two, the scope and the diversity of the program in hydrogen line research at Harvard expanded tremendously, and conceivably there was not as much attention to the quality of the spectra, and perhaps stimulated by the excitement of interpretation, there wasn't as much conservatism in the quality control of the data yeah. and the checking as there might have been. Clearly, that was what was on Menzel's mind when he asked mm-hmm. me to come, and in effect said, "Our major concern is the quality yeah. of the data. The interpretations may come and go, but at least the spectrum should survive the test of time."
What about the factor that Ewan was providing these receivers, not a member of the Harvard staff? I guess he maybe was officially, but anyway, he wasn't here very much. Then you had these graduate students using the equipment. It was a very different situation than all other radio astronomy at that time, which was done by people building their own receivers and putting them on the antennas and doing it themselves. Do you think that may have been a contributing thing, that the radio astronomy was as it actually is now in national observatories, you know, more of a black box approach? And
well, it's a black box approach now, and I don't think you can. I mean, my opinion for that split, where Ewan was providing mm-hmm. the equipment commercially to students and staff members who then used it here, I don't think that eliminates the responsibility of the people who use the equipment from or. It doesn't eliminate the responsibility, nor does it allow them to transfer the discredit, mm-hmm. if you will, back yep. to the manufacturer.
Still, you're saying the calibration, the checks for reproducibility, and so forth can be done. And
yes, I think there were. You know, it was very early in the hydrogen explosion of papers, and the enthusiasm was more mm-hmm. in the interpretation than in the quality of the data. An awful lot came out in a hurry. And some of it didn't survive yeah. the test of time. And it was an awkward period.
Let me ask finally about your interest in low-frequency satellite astronomy. You said that Dick Hugenin was the main person, actually, but can you just briefly tell me what you were doing around 1960 along those lines?
Well, it's hard to recall clearly, but my impression is that in the early days, Dick and I discussed the possibilities of low-frequency radio astronomy, getting the sensors above the atmosphere. I also recall he was, at that time, a member of the Society of... He was a junior fellow in the Society of Fellows at Harvard, which gives a student or a junior fellow considerable academic license. So, in effect, in our discussions, we outline the possibilities that might develop if one could put low-frequency sensors in space. Dick then made this one of his main objectives, and looked at the problems theoretically, and worked out an awful lot of models, and also considered the development of equipment. And his thesis is really a massive effort in outlining the potential of low-frequency radio astronomy, some of which I suspect is yet to be realized.
And you say he actually did get a couple antennas piggyback on some military satellites.
He did.
And did any useful observations come from these?
I think the nature of the rides, second class occupants, if you will, and the intermittent performance of the equipment, because in effect he had power only at the discretion of the military, and telemetry wasn't all that it might have been. I suspect those early flights were essentially written off.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you look back over the whole sweep of it, from when you entered the field through the early 60s in radio astronomy, any comments that you'd like to make about how it developed or how it's influenced astronomy as a whole?
The only thing that clearly stands out in my mind is the danger of presuming, when you're dealing with a new instrument, that you have some understanding of what likely is to happen. My main impression of those days is something of opening Pandora's box, and I suspect this is still true, whether it's a new X-ray observatory in space as we have today, or or some sensor that might be developed in the future. I think our knowledge of the inventory, if you will, of objects and processes in the universe, and the various manifestations they may have now and in the future, I suspect we only have a very dim idea of what that is.
Okay, thank you very much.
That ends the interview with Ed Lilly on 14 August 79.